This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
www.urbanharvest.org. You're listening to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Christmas Day, my brother, a litigation attorney, called from the San Antonio airport to say he would be late for the lunch we had scheduled. "You've got business on Christmas Day?" I asked, surprised. "Must be a big case going on hot and heavy." "No," he said. "I'm just trying to get in my frequent flyer miles before the year ends so that I can get to elite status." My mind did not quite compute this at first. "I don't get it. He's flying to San Antonio to get his elite status, as if his elite status was being stored in some locker at the San Antonio airport." And then it began to dawn on me. My brother had purchased a round-trip airplane ticket to fly to San Antonio and immediately back, with absolutely no purpose other than to rack up some frequent flyer air miles. How strange, I thought. I guess that elite status, which allows so-called free upgrades to first class when such openings are available, is highly coveted. And then I forgot about it and went back to preparing lunch. A few days later, as I was vegging out in front of the TV over the holidays, one of the networks threw up a story on this very activity, and I learned that what my brother had undertaken is known as a mileage run. The story further described an entire subculture of Americans who engage in this activity, using their own shorthand language for routes and airports and planes, and the existence of websites and magazines that help mileage runners plot their routes to maximize the mileage bang for their ticket buck. There were interviews with mileage runners who would board, for example, in Seattle, fly to Denver, change planes and head to Cincinnati, return west to San Francisco, and then head home again for Seattle. All of this aerial joyriding for no purpose other than to rack up miles towards elite status. There is no interest in visiting Denver, Cincinnati, or San Francisco. There are no people to see in those places. The mileage runners do not even really care where they are in earthly geographic terms. All they really know is that they are in a new airport, waiting to take off for another airport, sit back, be served some drinks and packaged food, and tick off the miles. Now, I've taken a few airplanes myself in the past few years, and I, of course, understand the desire to get the hell out of the coach section of the airplane and into first class. And now, with two small children, I understand that I am one of those loud and messy family groups from which others are desperately trying to escape. But I honestly don't know how to even begin to think about the economics of the mileage run. Not that airline economics has ever been easy to understand. Presumably, the airlines like this type of activity as it fills seats, even though it is the very definition of frivolous and unnecessary travel. Why not institute a way to purchase comparable air miles towards elite status without actually forcing someone to board a plane? Then the mileage runner's goal could be met, and an airline seat could be preserved for someone who truly wants or needs to travel to a destination. I tried to research what percentage of domestic air seats are purchased for mileage running, but could not find anything. It may be a totally insignificant number, and therefore not worthy of analysis, much less a monologue from me. Or it may be some surprisingly high number of total commercial passenger traffic, say 2% or more, that in effect forces the nation's air fleet and air traffic, and therefore fuel consumption and carbon emissions, to be that much larger than they really need to be. But either way, if there is one metaphor for the vast quantity of unreasonable and illogical waste of planetary resources so common in modern American culture, it seems to me it would have to be mileage running, in which people fly around in coach class on cramped, fuel-consuming jets so that they don't have to fly around in coach class on cramped, fuel-consuming jets. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. Back in a moment.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me. Let's fly away. Come fly with me. Let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just fly starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you. Weather-wise, it's such a lovely day. Just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near. You may hear angels cheer, 'cause we're together. Weather-wise, it's such a lovely day. You just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away.
Welcome back to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. Man, that song's got some great horns in it. Doesn't it? Gosh. www.newcapitalshow.com is our address on the web. www.kpft.org, the address of KPFT. Telephone number here, 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. We'll be taking your calls a bit later in the show. We'll open up the lines. You may like the New Capital Show. You may like all of the New Capital Show. I don't know. You may like the call-in. You may like the guests. Or you may only like the monologues. You may be... people have told me that. Yeah, Laura, they have. We don't like the rest of the show. I mean, that's, you know, but we like your monologues. If you are that person, or if you like the other things and you like the monologue, you can now sign up to receive the monologue to your email box. Or you can go straight to, or you can go straight to the website and see only the monologues. We now have something called the monoblog on the New Capital Show website, www.newcapitalshow.com. And all the monologues are now stored on one, you know, one deal, one thing. What do you call it? One blog. And it's just like any other blog now. We call it the monoblog. And so you can get to it. There's an entry today, and you can do this thing called RSS, which is syndication. So you can sign up to receive it into your feeder if you have a blog feeder. And you can also sign up if you want to have it delivered into your email box, the monologue. Okay, moving right along to a few other things. We've got a great couple of guests coming up next week. David K. Johnston, who is a writer for the New York Times as well as just an author, and Robert Greenwald, the guerrilla filmmaker. We're going to be talking about, I think we're going to be talking about taxation, an issue that I've touched on fairly frequently recently, the fairness of taxation, the levels of taxation, the nature of taxation in this country at the federal level. We'll probably also talk a bit about the subprime and mortgage crises. I've been asked about that. A little bit of news on those. Something caught my eye. It was something from the Wall Street Journal, January 3rd. Home prices must fall far to be in sync with rents. This is a study. It says U.S. house prices likely would have to fall considerably. And that is more than they have fallen. And, of course, this is a regional thing. You've got certain areas of the country, Portland, Seattle, the Pacific Northwest. Here in Texas, home prices have not fallen. But there are other parts of the country where the housing boom became a housing bubble. In those places, for example, prices in Miami, I think, fell about 10% recently announced. U.S. house prices likely would have to fall considerably more to return to a normal relationship with rents, says a study by one former and two current Federal Reserve economists. The study, which doesn't necessarily reflect the views of Fed policymakers, suggests prices would have to fall 15% over 5 years, assuming rents rose 4% a year. House prices would have to fall further if the adjustment took place more quickly. Basically, there is this, you know, there's a relationship. There's a relationship between the level of rents and the level of home prices. And that relationship can be basically understood in the same way that coupon payments on a bond are related to the price of the bond, right? Or the earnings of a business is related to the price of the business. In the same way, rents are related to the value of the real estate. Does that make sense? Whenever you have an asset, there is a payment stream that can be an income stream, right? Or a payment stream, whatever it is. If you're the payer of the stream, then it's a payment. If you're the receiver of it, then it's income. But in any case, there is a stream of payment that goes along with the asset. And when you have an asset value that is far beyond the level of that payment, then we have what would generally be considered to be an overvalued asset, right? Just think about that. If you have a business that earns $1 million a year and someone is willing to sell you that business for $1 million, is that a good deal or a bad deal? That's a heck of a deal, right? A million in 1 year, you've paid off the business with the earnings from the business, right? Or if somebody says, I've got a bond that's going to pay you $1 million a year, how much is the bond? $2 million. Is that a good deal or a bad deal? That's a pretty good deal, right? 2 years. In 2 years, the payment stream pays the asset. Similarly, if I said, I have an apartment complex that receives rents annually of $1 million, and I'm willing to sell you the apartment complex for $50 million, is that a good deal or not a good deal? $1 million it brings in, and you're going to pay $50 million. Not very good, right? It's going to take you 50 years to pay back that investment using the income from the rents. And this is what this article is basically saying, is that if you take prices in aggregate and look at rents, right, are still significantly below the value of where these assets are. And so it suggests that either rents have to rise very rapidly, which is probably not likely to happen given the current economic environment, or housing prices have to fall further. I'm not telling you that's going to happen. This is a study from Morris Davis, an economist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and until 2006, a staff economist at the Fed. In an interview, Mr. Davis said, lower long-term interest rates can explain only a small part of the drop in the ratio. To justify current price levels, well, this is just what I just said. You need rapid growth in rents. But it's hard to imagine the scenario that would justify such rapid growth in rents, he added. Of course, because we're seeing a slowing in the economy. If anything, we may see businesses and homeowners or renters demand greater price concessions. And in that case, we may see housing prices fall a little bit further. Let's see. What else has caught my eye? I liked this. I've talked about Michael Bloomberg before, and of course, there's a lot of discussion about him running for president. I frankly don't see. We can talk about the primaries on the show today. I haven't touched on it at all. I was going to. I mean, that was going to be the show. And then just somehow, a couple days ago, I just said, you know, I'm sick of it. I've had enough. Just enough. We're going to go back to some other. But if you want to talk about the primaries and the elections today, I'm more than happy to do it with you. Maybe over the past 2 days, I've recharged my batteries on it. We can talk about that. Anyway, Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, who I like. There is speculation he would run for president as an independent. I frankly don't see that there's really any room in the lineup for an independent. I think that a lot of the issues that he's covering are being covered. He's put a lot of focus, for example, on climate change, global warming, greater efficiency at the urban level, and as you just heard on Democracy Now!, the candidates themselves are actually focusing on these issues. It's the mass media that is not, which, of course, is no surprise to listeners of Pacifica, where we do focus on the major issues. Anyway, Michael Bloomberg, New York Times, December 30th, Bloomberg seeks new way to decide who is poor. The Bloomberg administration, frustrated by the federal government's Great Society method of determining who is poor, is developing its own measure, which city officials say will offer a more modern and accurate picture of poverty. Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg wants to adopt the new measure in part so he can better assess whether the tens of millions of dollars the city plans to spend on new anti-poverty programs will improve poor people's standard of living. But officials also hope the new measure will set off a nationwide re-examination of the current federal standard and prompt other cities and states to adopt the city's method. Again, this is another example in how cities and localities, municipalities, even states are developing a different approach and consciousness than our federal government under the Bush administration has, and have decided they're going to go it alone. Frankly, I think they'll be joined by the federal government after the next election or after the next inauguration, because we know that the Bush administration is going to do all it can between the next election and the next inauguration to put all sorts of stuff on the books that's noxious. So it's actually going to have to be, we're going to have to wait until Inauguration Day to see a change. At any rate, here's a little bit more on this poverty standard. The 42-year-old poverty standard, the federal poverty standard, which is pegged to the annual cost of buying basic groceries, is widely viewed as outdated and off target. The city's formula would take into account the money families must spend annually on, you know, more necessities, including rent, utilities, and child care. Right? I mean, the federal standard, can you buy food? doesn't take into account. Do you have a place to live? Doesn't take into account, can you pay a utility bill? Or do you have a way to help care for your children while you're at work? And the city's formula, the New York City's formula, the proposed change would add rent, utilities, and child care. But it would also factor in the value of financial assistance received, like housing vouchers or food stamps. The city's efforts are already attracting attention. Jack Tweedy, a director of the Children and Families Program at the Conference of State Legislators, says there is widespread dissatisfaction with the current standard. And so basically what we have is we've got some number of people below the poverty line, the federal poverty line in the country. I don't know what it is. I think it's about 10%. Can somebody help with that? Give us a call if you know where, you know, what percentage of Americans are now considered to be below the poverty line. I think it's about 10%. If you were to expand the definition of poverty, you know, I don't know what the number would say. Does the article talk about this? I don't see anything here. At any rate, we can assume that we might see, you know, 20%. A quarter, who knows? Some percent of the U.S. population, using a new definition of the poverty line, could well fall below it. People who do not have adequate resources to pay for, in aggregate, food, rent, utilities, and child care. I mentioned a few weeks ago there's news that people are using credit cards to pay for utilities, especially in colder climates this winter. And presumably those people would fall below the poverty line. To me, this is a big deal. When the country has to suddenly, I mean, we use these categories and they kind of take on their own aura and their own meaning. So it's one thing to say, you know, I mean, look, 10% is a huge number. You know, it's one thing to say a tenth of the population lives in poverty, technical poverty in this country. It's another thing to say a quarter does, a fourth. One out of four people. Not one out of ten, one out of four. You know, or one out of five. And so I really applaud Mayor Bloomberg and the City of New York's effort to redefine. We ought to track this. We ought to see where this goes and how it goes. And, of course, it has enormous implications for what social welfare programs are enacted. It has enormous implications. If we suddenly say that one out of four people are below the poverty line and cannot afford these basic services, then you can already see the political dimensions of what follows from that. And we can probably, although I don't want to say for sure, we can probably say that liberals, progressives, would say we need a wider safety net. And presumably conservatives, I don't know, Republicans, might say, oh, no, this is, you know, we can't expand the safety net. And, of course, this country faces significant budget deficits, federal budget government deficits right now, where we have more outflow from the government than we have taxes coming in. And to fund the shortfall, the United States must borrow from abroad. And we're doing that, largely these days from China, Japan, to fund our shortfalls. We take on debt. And so, to me, the political implications of a redefinition of what is poverty are enormous and could well be one of the major issues, could become the issue, over which an expansion in the safety net, perhaps changes in the economy, all take place. That's what's coming out of New York right now. Next up, let's talk about a couple of environmental issues. We're following the issue in California, which is California has now sued the EPA. We had Matt Paua, a great global warming environmental attorney, on several weeks ago. Matt talked about the fact that at the time the decision hadn't been handed down by the EPA. Matt said he couldn't see any way that the EPA would not grant California a waiver to establish its own environmental fuel economy standards and emission standards. And yet, in a decision that totally shocked everybody, even those familiar with the Bush administration, the administrator of the EPA, I think his name is Stephen Johnson, and basically against the advice of others in the EPA who work for him and are tasked with rendering advice, Mr. Johnson essentially single-handedly said that the EPA would not grant California a waiver to determine its own emission standards, that California's emission standards would have to be in line and similar, exact, to those promulgated by the EPA at the federal level. And, of course, California, under Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, a Republican, has now sued the EPA, and there are expected to be other states, another 15 states or so that are going to join the suit. This has happened time and time again under the Bush administration. Lawsuits from the states to right to establish their own right to environmental protection, to customize federal rules or to customize other rules, and have been denied that right. And, of course, this is the same Republican government that says, oh, well, we don't believe in strong federal government. We don't believe in government. We don't believe we want to take government apart. We want to return the power to the people. Yeah, sure. Sure you do. You don't want to give Californians the right to even determine their own air quality standards. Just one more line of hypocrisy. I mean, and there's so many that have come from Republican rule. In 2002, when I started this radio show, I thought that Republican rule in the country would be over in 10 years, and I said it. And, of course, that sounded nutty at the time, 2002, right? This was in many ways, the peak of the Bush, and in many ways, the peak of Republican rule in this country, actually, I don't think they controlled the Senate at the time. They did control the House, but they would gain control of the Senate in 2004, 2 years later. They were about to launch the war in Iraq, and of course, it looked like they were going to dominate politics forever. And I said, no, there are too many internal contradictions in this party. I said that the Republican Party, a party populated by MBAs who would declare themselves to be stewards of rigorous accounting, but who refuse to account for using natural, social, and other types of capital for their economic activities. I thought it was a party that would talk about being pro-life, while at the same time totally ignoring the value of life in non-human species, in entire ecosystems, and even with economically disadvantaged humans. You know, a total inconsistency. Waging wars that caused and have caused enormous amounts of casualties while preaching something they call pro-life. The news today out of a study on Iraq is 150,000, I think it's 150,000 dead in Iraq. And I've seen even higher estimates. It's very hard to know what type of death what quantity of death that conflict has caused, but it has caused enormous amounts and continues to. Republican Party, a party of well-educated and privileged people who would willfully ignore the objective findings of our best-educated scientists, who increasingly warn of planetary distress, who daily tell the story of evolutionary history from fossil records and biological records, a party that preaches patriotism and nationalism while at the same time savaging commonly owned interests like public lands, air, water, and public treasuries. A party that preached fiscal responsibility while at the same time making the word tax, which is critical to a budget. It's the financing part of a budget. They made the word tax an evil word rather than helping Americans understand what does a good tax look like and what does a bad tax look like. We have to have taxes. You want to have a nation? You want to have a treasury? You have to have tax. The word exists for a reason. It's income to a government levied by a government on its citizens. And it's not a bad word. It's a method that can be misused. And there are bad taxes and there are good taxes. There are taxes that are congruent with goals, and there are taxes that cause consequences and cause outcomes that were unexpected. And in so many ways, I felt that the Republican Party was absolutely inconsistent in its positions, and it would not hold on to power. And I think that 10 years is really going to be more like 6 years. I really do. 713-526-5738. Just a couple of other, I won't get into these very deeply, but home monitoring tools are coming about now. There are tests that are going on that allow people to basically plug their electric systems and all of their gas systems in their homes into their personal computers in their homes, and apparently this facilitates enormous savings when people are able to see and monitor what's going on inside the house using these digital tools, that they affect much greater savings and much less consumption of utility resources. And these products are coming along. It needs a boost. Someone in the article says it's going to take a lot more testing before this comes along. And I say, I don't know why. I mean, this is basic stuff. This is sensors connected to digital readers, digital sensors, and a software interface. This stuff goes on now every single day, all over this country. There's no reason why this can't be brought to the fore and implemented on a nationwide basis and quickly. And news out of California, of course, our friends in California, utilities, this is from Wall Street Journal of yesterday, utilities in California amp up push to slash energy use. California pays bonuses for reducing demand and switching to light bulbs. 37% of energy household use in California comes from lighting. And, of course, the utilities there are pushing for CFLs. What is the problem? The problem is that utilities for so long in this country have been paid to build more plants and generate power from those plants and take a margin above that. And what's happening now is that there are efforts to encourage ways for utilities to actually make money by encouraging conservation. This is crucial. This is crucial. We're not going to get there without utilities. They play an enormous role in helping us change the way we consume. And I absolutely agree that they should be incentivized through a profit motive to encourage saving. And of course, that's going on in California. California's biggest utility is making a huge financial bet on solving a light bulb riddle. How much energy can it conserve by getting its customers to remove one sort of bulb and screw in another? To cut energy costs and help reduce the emissions that cause global warming, PG&E, which is Pacific Gas and Electric Corp., are facing an unusual imperative. They need to convince consumers to use less of their product. Right? Think about that. The utilities need to convince consumers to use less of their product. What a radical notion, but what a brilliant notion. Can we incentivize utilities to convince consumers to use less? I've gotten several emails recently on peak load, and especially in response, and I want to thank Stephen Reitman for filling in. He did a great job last week. I got several emails in response to that about peak load, talking about how we need to understand peak loads and where alternative energy sources play a role in peak loads. We need to understand consumption of energy much better than we do now. It's not enough to just use averages. We have to to a much greater, finer degree, be able to pinpoint how, when, where is energy being used, and use different sources of energy, digital monitoring tools, and yes, marketing and business model incentives in utilities themselves. PG&E is staking its success on getting consumers to junk conventional incandescent light bulbs in favor of energy-efficient CFLs. My friends, if you can afford to do this, you should do it. I mean, the difference between an incandescent light bulb and a CFL in terms of the amount of energy it uses is like one-fifth. One-fifth. So a 60-watt light bulb, the CFL equivalent, consumes about 10 watts. That's not one-fifth, that's one-sixth. But usually it's not 10, it's usually like 12, 13 watts, whatever, something like that. So it's one-fifth. And the quality of the light is very close now. The products have gotten to that point that they're very close in terms of product quality and reliability. They last longer, they cost more, but ultimately it's savings. Now, I talked about at the beginning of the show, you have an asset, it has a payment stream, right? Well, these light bulbs have a payment stream. You buy this light bulb, it's an asset, and the payment streams are much lower, right? You're going to pay more for the light bulb, but you're going to pay less for the payment streams. Is that a good deal? Yes, that is a good deal. Utilities across the country are watching the results of PG&E. About half of U.S. energy use flows through the nation's utilities, and a powerful combination of rising fuel costs and climate change fears is putting increasing pressure on them to find ways to reduce the demand. Coal plants are causing environmental concerns. Natural gas is subject to huge price swings. Nuclear plants remain controversial, and even wind farms are proving hard to site without opposition. So producing less energy has new appeal for utilities' bottom lines. My friends, at the outset of the show, I talked about people flying around in airplanes for no purpose other than to accumulate miles. And it's really is a metaphor for our energy use on a nationwide basis. You know, we burn light bulbs in rooms we're not standing in. We burn light bulbs that are outdated and inefficient when we could consume other ones. We set our temperature in our homes at levels that shouldn't be. We drive cars that are inefficient, and we take routes that are inefficient. I truly believe that we are on the cusp of an energy revolution. That sounded radical when I started doing this show. I don't think it sounds radical anymore here in 2000. What year are we in, Laura? Is it 8 now? I went to sleep at 9 p.m. on New Year's, so I wasn't there for the change in the year. In 2008, I think it's very clear to everybody. Can we take a short break? We'll come back. We're going to take your call. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. This is New Capital Show. We'll be back in just a moment. Back to the New Capital Show. Just a couple of things. CARA provides us with the information that the number of people, the percentage of people underneath the poverty line, again, this is the Great Society old style way of calculating poverty, is 12%. So I said 10, we're not too far off. John asked, what would be a good tax, and is the income tax a good tax? A good tax is a tax that causes, that raises money in a just way, and the proceeds are used to affect communal interests in a positive way that the nation decides is, or that the population decides has a positive effect. Generally, a bad tax is where you get unintended consequences. A tax that may raise money from one source and be used in another way, oftentimes you can see that I see that as a bad tax, where there's absolutely no link between the financing and the use of the tax for the project. So those are just some initial ideas. But we can talk about that, and I think we will next week with our guests. Let's go to Kayvon on line two. Kayvon, welcome to the show.
All right, you can have the whole 1 second. How you doing, man?
I'm good.
All right. Man, I just went into a gas station. 1 second, all right? I've been going to my car. No, you know what? Screw it. Not 1 second. I see all you're talking about. You talk about, I've been listening to you for about 30 minutes now,
mm-hmm.
and you've covered many, many, many issues. Now, what I want to ask is, when it comes to all these issues, I wanted to try to come to some kind of core, some kind of a central issue that will tackle all these things you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you have an idea that will, I mean, all these issues have to deal, obviously, with some kind of, like, central issue. Like, all these things you're talking about, it must have some sort of core that can be dealt with that will tackle all these issues. Like these, all these issues you're talking about, they must have some sort of base.
Kayvon, what I like to talk about on this show, and the reason we call it the New Capital Show, is, and you ask an excellent question.
Yes.
You're asking, as you listen to me, what is the overall philosophy here? And the overall...
I'm talking about so many things, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, I'll tell you what. Let me hang up. You're at the gas station. I hope they're not going to hit you too hard at the pump, and I'll talk about this.
I'm back in my car.
Okay. I'll talk about this for just a second. So let's let you off here. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the question. The basic idea is that when you undertake an activity, it's important that all of your costs be accounted for. If you can account for all of your costs, and you can see that your activity is going to yield a return above the cost of the use of all of those resources, and we call that capital, then you have what would be defined as an activity or a project that is good. Let's call it good. It's a project that should be pursued. But that when you leave out all sorts of costs of the effect of your project, then we have bad results. We have bad results. And that's the basic philosophy that I've been talking about since I started this show many years ago. And what we've learned in the last few years is that many of our activities have costs which we have not been counting. And, of course, the big example I use all the time is the consumption of energy. And the energy that we use in this country, 60% of it comes from coal. And we see that there are emissions that are going into the atmosphere from use of this coal, and yet the energy has been cheap. And the reason for that is very simply that we're not counting the costs of global warming, we're not counting the costs of pollution, and yet there are ways that you can look at this in every single thing that you do. And so the way that goods get priced in our society, the way that regulations get promulgated, and the way that projects get green-lighted or not green-lighted all has to do with, are we costing out the resources needed to do projects? I hope that helps. You can find more on newcapitalshow.com. We've got something called the New Capital Show or the New Capital Manifesto, and that's available on the website. I would encourage anyone to follow up with Kayvon's question to check that out. It's kind of an espousing of the philosophy of the show. Thanks very much, Kayvon. Let's take Roz next. Roz, welcome. Oh, my gosh.
Hey. How are you doing?
Oh, my gosh.
A lot of noise.
It sounded like R2-D. Sounded like you're with R2-D2 or something.
Oh, yeah. I was in an electronics store. But I just wanted to piggyback on what you said about, the frequent flyer thing earlier.
Yeah.
And and you kind of tied it all into this overconsumption, not just of energy, but just of things in general.
Yes.
And I am a marketing professor, and I can tell you, one of the things that I'm working with now or starting to either write more about or think more about is marketing's role in this, kind of in this new thinking.
I love it. I love it, Roz. There's so much to be done by the marketers to reinvent that. It's such a great opportunity.
Right, it is. It is a wonderful opportunity. And one of the things is for marketing to develop a conscience. Now, we talk about marketing ethics. I mean, and we kind of give lip service to that in the courses, right?
Uh-huh.
But it's time for marketing to really have a conscience. So it goes beyond ethics,
yeah,
right?
And it's going from more is never enough to less is more, right? I mean,
right. And I'm encouraged, I kind of throw this in my classes, right? And is it better to have more of a lot of mediocre things or a few really good quality things?
Yep, you bet.
So that's one of the issues, and maybe we can talk more about that at some other time. But I think that's really, really important, and marketing, either, corporate, small business, all of it is going to have to address that.
Roz, thanks for the call. It's just great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Roz is right on top of it. There is going to have to be a sea change in the way that marketing occurs in this country. And she's exactly right. We've got to go from, would you like to have a lot of stuff that's not valuable to you or a few things that are valuable to you, right? We need to go from more is never enough to less is more. And that's going to have enormous ramifications for how people and companies design, produce, and market their products. Because I do think we're going to see a return to high quality and meaningfulness as people derive much more meaning from smaller size of things, from fewer lower quantities of things. And anyway, Roz, great call. Thanks very much. Next up, let's take Louie. Louie, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi, Leo. How you doing
good
today?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
Hey, I must agree with what you said earlier about, you know, how sick it is just to watch a little bit of the coverage of the whole who's going to be the next president.
Yeah.
Correct? You mentioned something like that, and I must agree with you. Now, on the other hand, me, myself, personally, the reason I don't listen to shows like Rush Limbaugh and Hannity is because they're always saying how bad one party is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're biased as far as... And the sad thing about this whole thing is... I got to say that the fact is that it's sad to see that all these people that are running for president, they get all this coverage, and supposedly all the polls are, you know, on their side, whatever. They're really pro-war. Barack Obama, you know, supports the war, wants to send 100,000 troops over there, and Hillary Clinton voted for the war. And they're de facto Democrats. The only two persons, Dennis Kucinich, who was against the war in Iraq and all this, you know, the war issue, they're being silenced. And also on the Republican side, you got Ron Paul, which is really a real putting his life on the line, sticking out really something that he can actually back up. And the sad thing is they're being silenced. And you cannot say this party is bad or this party is bad. I don't believe in that. What I believe is who's really telling the truth, who's really speaking for us. Not according to gender, not according to religion, like Huckabee, not according to gender, being a female like Hillary Clinton, you know, for mass appeal. And but you got to really look at it, the fact that they're really standing for the same things that we're struggling, the same headaches, the same, you know, blood that has been spilled. And to me, that's a very sensitive issue. And the sad thing is about this whole coverage of the media of, you know, who's running for president. They're really backing up the war.
Louis, thanks.
Really, nobody's really saying anything about it.
Louis, thanks
and
for the call. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
You know, listen, I think, first of all, it is great that people are taking an interest in these primaries. So I don't mean to convey that that's bad. I'm finding the major network news coverage to be a bit insipid about it. The focus on, you know, Hillary Clinton tears up. And, I mean, issues are the issue. Issues are the issue. And, I think the Barack story coming out of Iowa was and is and will continue to be very compelling. It's not that. But the coverage, in my opinion, in the past week has kind of veered into areas where that we've seen all too often, insipid coverage, focus on minutia of candidates and the inflection of a word they said that turned the thing around. Louis is right. The focus needs to be on issues. What candidates represent your issues? What, you know, and even what candidate do you like? You can like a candidate. I'm not saying that somebody, can't vote for someone just because they like them. But you know, we need to keep the focus on the issues. And sometimes the major networks just veer off into other areas. Let's keep rolling right along. We've got about 10-15 minutes left in the show. Let's take Rick. Rick's been holding a while. Rick, welcome.
Hi, yeah. Leo, I wanted to talk about energy, basically the twin catastrophes of energy and basically peak oil or even peak energy and global warming, and link that to, the campaigns we have going on now.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I've taken this approach in my personal life. I have taken to basically introduce energy efficiency where I can, even so far as I don't have a Prius, but the car I do have, I drive as efficiently as I can. And my four-cylinder Camry just got about 32 miles city and 39 highway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's just through aggressive energy conservation tactics, you know, basically aggressive techniques in conserving energy while I drive. So, like right now, as I talk to you, I'm not using my air conditioning. I have no electronics on in my car. My headlights are not on, and I'm basically obeying the speed limit, you know, okay? My personal life, compact fluorescence in my home on the personal level. On the approach of the campaign level in this primary season, I think it's a big mistake to look to any leader, any party, with regards to how they're going to aggressively attack these issues of global warming and peak fossil fuel. And by peak fossil fuel, I also include coal.
Okay. So what are you? What should we look to? Rick?
I think we need to look to ourselves as grassroots in terms of grassroots organizing.
Yeah.
And basically placing political heat on them that's impossible to ignore. We have examples of this with the communications law, the FCC trying to increase concentration of ownership. It's basically politically radioactive now to be for consolidation of media, and that's because everybody across the political spectrum hates it. And we're seeing the same convergence on energy with, I disagree with them vehemently, but you have people like Admiral... the CIA director, I'm trying to remember his name, James Woolsey,
yeah.
And Frank Gaffney Jr., who was the Assistant Secretary of Defense under Reagan, coming out very strongly for, things like, say, plug-in hybrids,
yeah,
and such like that. So it needs that kind of approach, and for crying out loud, even though I detest him, Oliver North, coming out for these things, though, I mean, he has his own tactical reasons for doing this, but, regardless, when you have that kind of broad understanding of the situation, the trick now is to link it together and form some massive movement where it's just absolutely radioactive to go against the interests of the public.
Rick, I think we're getting there, too. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. Rick is right. It is going to take everybody. It's going to take the Ollie Norths of the world. It's going to take the Jim Woolseys. And I think it's great that we are seeing, in my opinion, a set of issues around which people can coalesce. And I don't think that it's any mistake that we're probably going to see so-called, moderates emerge as candidates for the president. Now, I understand that word can mean different things to different people, but, I think if you saw a John McCain nomination means to me a different thing than say a Giuliani or a Romney nomination. May not mean all that much, but I do think it means something. As Amy Goodman pointed out in her show, or as her guest pointed out, John McCain has spoken out very forcefully about global warming and the need to pass a pristine, clean legacy to our children and to future generations. So, Rick is exactly right. It's going to take everybody. There's no room for "this is my movement." To change the energy profile, the consumption profile, the marketing profile, all of these things are such large issues. Every single one of us plays a role. I saw an ad for one of the green conferences. There are lots of green conferences, and I thought it was a very good ad. It was just a set of like speaking bubbles. In a cartoon, when somebody says something, what do you call that? A speech bubble or something. There's a thought bubble which has the little circles going, and there's a speech bubble. Little speech bubbles, not attached to anybody, just implying, I'm saying this. And what struck me, I thought, speaking of marketing, each thing said, had a different thing about what someone's going to do. I'm going to ride my bike to work. I'm going to start a global green website. I'm going to change over my automobile company's product line. Every single one of these things, regardless of how big they're perceived to be or how small they're perceived to be, have a critical role to play. And that's what's so wonderful, is that I think that changing our consumptive profile in this country, and that means energy, that means stuff, and there are social justice components, education, all of it to me is wrapped into one. Kayvon was asking about what's the overall picture that I'm trying to draw. The overall picture that I'm trying to draw is one of appropriate, proper, rigorous use of capital for projects. We've got to get back to that. If we can do that, we have wonderful possibilities. We've just got a few minutes left, so let's head back and take a few more calls before we're out of time. Matt is next. Matt, welcome to the show.
I just kind of had a question about compact fluorescent light bulbs. I've got quite a few in my house and everything. I was wondering, I had heard that there was going to be some legislation kind of ending incandescent light bulbs.
Yeah, there are a number of countries that have already done that, Matt, but yes, I don't know where that legislation stands in this country. But yes, and we're seeing more of that worldwide.
Well, I was kind of wondering, because for some instances, like if you've got one in your closet or something, isn't it better, if it's only going to be on for 10, 15 seconds, just to use an incandescent light bulb?
You know, I ask myself that question, too. Is it more environmental to retain the bulb that you have rather than causing the product waste, knowing that an incandescent bulb is a pretty flimsy piece of glass and a piece of metal? And I don't have an answer to that. I'll bet you there's information on it. There's probably some formula for where it's best to replace it and where it's not. But I think that the general consensus is that the easiest thing to do is just to say out with the incandescents and in with the CFLs. And I think that's basically where these things are going. But your question is a valid one. At what point do I cause this enormous solid waste problem by having thrown out 50 light bulbs from my house? But I think that the consumption of energy is, I mean, as I said, it's 1/5 to 1/6, something like that, of the incandescent that it more than makes up for it in the reduced energy usage, Matt. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this last past year I've tried to conserve as much as possible, and I've gotten down only about 8,000 kilowatts all of last year, so I'm pretty happy about that.
You're saying that by using these bulbs you've reduced your usage?
And that, among, you know, other things too, just turning things off, setting the thermostat higher, stuff like that.
Yep. Okay, Matt, thanks.
Thank you.
Got to move along. Let's take Dennis. Dennis.
Yeah, hey, Lil. Kind of about taxes. You know, they talk about how much the cost of this war is, and, you know, anywhere from in the hundreds of billions into the trillions and stuff like that. Where's this money going? I mean, who's actually profiting from this war? And you know, I mean, I know the soldiers aren't getting rich. You know, the people are
No, they're not, Dennis. Soldiers are not getting rich. Dennis, I mean, we could do an entire show on it. I don't have a quick and ready answer for you, other than to say that from where I sit, it doesn't look to me as if the money that has been spent is going to yield a return for our society in aggregate. In fact, I don't think it's even close. I think the money, which is in the trillions that is being spent, will have very little return and could even have negative returns. And that is not the kind of investment that you want to make. So if we're looking at it from a capital utilization standpoint, I think that the investment in Iraq has been an absolute disaster. Does that help to begin to answer the question for you?
Well, like I say, I mean, is there a website or something you can go to from the government, or is this all double secret probation stuff that you know, we're not allowed to know about?
Dennis, I'm just about out of time, but my understanding is that the funding of the war has come both through direct allocations made to the war as well as through omnibus bills where provisions for the war have been made within the context of other allocations as well. And basically the Bush administration has done whatever they feel needed to be done to fund the war through the different funding mechanisms of the federal government. Okay? I don't have any particular website right now, but I'm sure that it's out there. If anybody can help me with that, send me an email. You can reach me at www.newcapitalshow.com. There's an email form there. Send me what you've got, and I'll try to get this up on the website. It's an excellent question from Dennis. Okay? Dennis, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be back with you. Happy New Year to everybody. Great to be back. And we'll be back next week again. David K. Johnston and Robert Greenwald will be joining me as my guests, and we will be talking about taxes and probably the mortgage crisis as well. This has been another edition of the New Capital Show. Up next is Thresholds. Take care.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards. But if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and at the same time take care of that unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transferred. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's that simple to support the station you've come to rely on. rely on for alternative music, news, and public affairs programming. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, radio for people.
The Youth Radio Show is looking for young, dedicated volunteers to help produce weekly segments which will then air on the show Saturday nights at 9 p.m. As a Youth Radio volunteer, you'll receive free training in sound engineering, interviewing techniques.
Do you think we should raise the driving age?
It'd be reasonable to keep it the same.
Live production skills and more. Radio is fun, so why not get involved? If you would like to get involved, email us at getinvolved@youthradio.com.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.